If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So one of America's most respected, recognized, and experienced broadcast journalists, Leslie Stahl, is celebrating her 26th season on the iconic CBS News magazine 60 Minutes. Leslie has won nearly a dozen Emmy Awards. She has covered every president since the end of the Nixon administration, including an exclusive interview with the Trump family last November. The most vivid and transformative experience of Leslie's life was not covering the White House. It was becoming a grandmother. In the New York Times bestselling book, Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting, which is now available in paperback, Leslie has explored how grandparenting changes a person's life. And to share that journey of grandparenting, Leslie Stahl joins us in studio this morning. Good morning, Leslie.
Morning, Dave. It's so nice to be here.
So great to have you in studio. And I must tell you, congratulations on 26 years on 60 Minutes.
Oh, you make it sound so long. Oh, my goodness.
You're just a baby.
It's flown by. I miss the guys I started with, like Mike.
Yeah.
And more recently, Morley Dyed and Bob Simon. But for me, I love what I do. Each story, I'm a grandmother, but each story is a baby.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
I get deeply into it. The great thing about 60 Minutes is that we get to pick our own stories.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
We like everyone that we do. We're committed to it. So it's a
and
good
you're,
thing.
And you're invested in that story, obviously.
Precisely, yeah.
Exactly. So you were grandmother to Jordan and Chloe, and as a grandmother, it has really transformed your life.
Total. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not unique. When I first held my first granddaughter, Jordan, the physicality of my emotion was so enormous and unexpected. It was kind of a total body, down to my toes, elation. And everyone always says it's wonderful to be a grandparent, but no one told me about that.
Were you surprised that it
totally
took you over?
Totally surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Well, am I special and unique and only I had that? Or is this what it means to be a grandmother? Do we all get that? And most of us do, I discovered. And I'm going to make everyone read the book, but I discovered what happens to a grandmother physiologically.
Yeah.
When she holds her baby. And we do have physical transformations.
Yeah, there's scientists and doctors who have said it was who've proven that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just me. And it's a very deep thing. And so we are changed mentally in our outlook by the joy of having a grandchild, but we're also changed physically.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talked about this willingness to more readily accept an older woman in a position of leadership. Specifically, in most families, grandmothers carry a moral authority but also a sense of warmth. There's a balance there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you take someone who, and I say that this is more and more true today. You take a woman who's a grandmother who has a PhD or an MBA or she's a doctor or an airline pilot. She carries the moral authority along with this new sense of competence, really. And so I was surprised that Hillary, for instance, didn't spend more time than she did talking about being a grandmother, because I think it would have enhanced the warm side
different
of
connection.
Her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you've talked to anthropologists, too, so, from evolutionary terms, and asked the question, why are there grandmothers?
Well, if you look at the animal kingdom, animals die when they can no longer reproduce.
Yeah.
There are very, very, very few animals that extend beyond that. Us, elephants, and whales. Now,
wow.
I loved finding that out more than anything. That was my most delicious discovery.
Yeah.
But they always wondered, they being anthropologists, why there are grandmothers in that, all we do is take food away from the family. What are we contributing?
Yeah,
why
yeah.
are they here?
Yeah.
And the reason turns out to be, according to the grandmother theory, that we're here to babysit.
Yeah.
And people find that funny, but it's not. Because grandmothers took care of the babies in the cave, both parents could go out and hunt and forage for food and bring back the nourishment to keep the baby healthy. And it allowed us as human beings to continue to reproduce and survive. So survival of the fittest. Grandmothers were essential.
Well, you talk about today the high cost of childcare, and grandparents are spending more time with than ever with their grandkids, and pushing a growing number of baby boomer grandparents into this child-rearing seat once again. Does that do you feel like that takes some responsibility away from the parents and puts a little bit too much onus on the grandparents these days?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
What seems to be happening, and it's across the country, is that the young parents need their parents to help both in terms of childcare, but also in terms of money, financial support,
totally,
than before. Because kids today are not making enough money in terms of just purchasing power to support the family. And the older generation, and this is quite unusual, has more money.
Right.
That's true. We have more money.
Yeah.
And so we are being called to service by our children. They want us. They need us. My generation, you know, if you said to me, your mother's going to move next door, I would have thought, oh, my God, my mother's going to move next door, please.
That would scare me a little, but yeah.
The attitude is changing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we are needed more.
They're very present, absolutely.
And, of course, all grandmothers, including my mother back then, all we want is those babies.
Sure.
That's all we want.
Sure.
So if we're invited, we'll come.
Well, and then there's also this therapeutic effect, really, of becoming a grandmother. And I have to relate a little bit. So I'm going to be 50 this year, and I have a 16-year-old son, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and I have a 4-year-old.
Ooh.
All the same family, all the same wife, a little surprise at the end.
Yeah, yeah, clearly.
But I do the math, and I realize, you know, okay, I'm going to be 70-ish when my youngest graduates from college and so forth. But, you know, I think it's brought therapy to my life a little bit to a degree, because it's brought this newfound joy and even longer, you know, time that I'm going to be able to spend with him growing up.
But when you're a grandfather,
yeah,
and you're 70 or maybe older, you're going to be healthier than the image people have of 70.
Yeah.
Because not only are we all going to live longer, most of us. I know that there are studies that saying mortality is shrinking in some communities. But for most of us, it's not just living longer. We're going to live longer healthily.
Right.
We're going to have better health into our 90s.
Yeah.
So you'll be an energetic 80.
Well, yeah, 70 is nowhere near what our grandparents' 70s
exactly,
were. Nowhere
exactly.
Nowhere near. When I look at pictures, I'm like, wow. And today, 70 is like 50.
Exactly.
It really is. Yeah.
In terms of our energy, our ability to chase after a little kid at the park.
That's true.
I speak from firsthand knowledge. So don't worry about being a little older, because you probably, well, you did wait, obviously. And our children are going to be a little older. So we are going to be older grandparents.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now, you were in your daughter's delivery room before the baby was born. Was that really the start of it? Was it when the baby was born, or was it really that whole experience?
At the very last second, the doctor arrived. I thought rather late in the process, but there he was. And he said to my daughter, "Are your parents staying?" And she said, "No." And I was devastated. So we were right outside the room. Mm-hmm. And about 2 minutes after the baby was born, we went in. And my daughter would not relinquish the baby to me for a long time, because I sat and watched my daughter, who, frankly, I didn't see as maternal, instantly turn into Madonna.
Wow.
There she was, staring at her child in total rapture. And that's what contributed, seeing my baby turn
into a mom.
To the perfect mom.
Wow.
Before my very eyes. And then when I was finally allowed to hold my granddaughter, well, that emotion that we talked about just
unloaded.
Unloaded with such a hit and a wallop and a wham and a wow.
Wow.
And I was hooked. And then I had a second one, and it happened all over again. So
amazing.
Amazing.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And with this, in the book, you've interviewed so many friends and colleagues about this very subject.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what was astonishing? Mm-hmm. I have a lot of girlfriends who are step-grandmothers.
Okay.
And if they were in that family when the grandchild is born, they have exactly the same kind of emotion. So it isn't necessarily the biological connection. It's the personal connection with that baby with you. You hold it and you're connected. You're bonded to that child.
And it's not only grandmothers, it's grandfathers too, because you interviewed some other folks in the book, including Tom Brokaw, who had very similar reactions to that, right?
Well, you know, grandfathers get that, but a little later. Grandmothers have it with the instant that infant who is only able to poop and cry, you know, and
true.
The grandmother is in rapture.
Yeah.
The grandfather, it seems, it hits a little later when the baby starts actually looking back and relating in some way, and particularly once that child knows who grandpa is.
That's true.
Then grandpa can actually get more kind of gaga than grandma.
How old are the grandkids now?
Mine are 3.5 and 6.
But you know there's a time where they realize that you're their mom's mom. There's that moment
exactly.
where they make that connection.
Exactly.
Isn't that fabulous?
It's everything's fabulous. Yeah. And we do a lot of FaceTiming, other people Skype, when you live across the country as we do.
Yeah,
we're in their lives that way, thank goodness, a lot. And there is also that aha moment when they mm-hmm. actually realize that it's grandma and they're talking to grandma and they can pick up the phone themselves and call grandma.
Yeah, right.
They don't call me grandma, by the way. They call me Lolly.
Okay.
And my husband is Pop. I'm about to make everybody groan. Lollipop.
Yeah.
Groaner.
Okay.
But we are. We're Lollipop.
Yeah.
And so I can remember when the older one called me the first time.
That's wonderful.
To tell me something. Oh, my gosh.
Just last week, my 16-year-old, who just got his driver's license, drove my 11-year-old daughter to my parents' house.
Oh, my God. Were you terrified?
I was a little bit. He's been driving. He's a good, safe driver, and he puts his phone in the glove compartment. He's a good kid. But when the door opened, my son was explaining this to me, and my father and mother opened the door and saw just the two of them and kind of looked beyond them to be like, who else? Did you get here by us? But the fact that they took the initiative and said, you know, we're going to go drive over and bring some cupcakes that she baked and go see Grandma and Grandpa, I think it was one of the best moments of life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And the other thing is, you're telling me the story, and I know exactly what was going on inside your parents, because grandparents have a community. We know how we're feeling.
Yeah.
And it is hard to explain.
Yeah.
I talked to a woman this morning who was bored with her girlfriends when they would talk about having grandchildren. She yawned, and then she had her own.
That's awesome.
And now she's just like them.
Now she gets it.
Yeah,
now
and she wants to talk about her grandchildren.
Best quote of the book, and I love this quote, it's never too late to have the best day of your life. It's true.
It's my favorite quote, too.
It's fantastic.
And you think, you've seen it all. You think you've had your emotional highs. You probably think by the time you're a grandparent that your emotions have leveled out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not sinking into despair as
right.
much, but you're not having your highs either. And all of a sudden this happens.
But you've had, speaking of best days of your life, you have had the most amazing career in broadcast journalism. And I know you went to Columbia University, but you were studying zoology, I think.
Exactly.
<right?
laughs> They have this great school of journalism, and there I am dissecting a frog. Yeah. I learned pretty soon at graduate school in zoology that this was not for me because I didn't want to touch anything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I wanted to wear gloves for everything. And the assistant professor came by, I remember, and he said, you know, if you don't want to touch anything, you're not going to be a good doctor.
Good tip.
Okay, I'm out of here.
That's a good tip. Is that kind of where you said, what else am I going to do? And was journalism the calling at that point?
You're not going to believe this. No. I answered an ad in the New York Times. I quit graduate school, and it said researcher. And I majored in history in college, and I love doing research. So I answered the ad. And it turned out to be a job at the mayor's office in New York working on the speechwriting staff. And I loved that job. Had no idea in my head where it was taking me. Just loved the job. And walked into the press room one day, where the reporters hang out in City Hall, and asked one of the reporters, what do you do all day? And when he finished telling me, I knew.
That was it for
that
you.
That was it.
That was it for you. And I know you also worked for NBC News. You were on to London working for the Huntley Brinkley Report. Was it at that time you weren't feeling very challenged, like you wanted to do more than what you were doing at that time?
Well, they sent me NBC. I'd worked on the campaign as a researcher, the 1968 presidential campaign as a researcher. And then NBC sent me to London, and I wasn't being challenged at all. I was, when you talk about junior, what's three steps below junior? That was me.
Mm-hmm.
And a really wonderful man, then president of NBC News, Richard Wald, took me aside and he said, you know, you think you're going to start at the top. NBC News, that's the top. If you really, really want to be a serious journalist, you have to go backward, take five steps backward, and start at the very beginning and learn every step of being a journalist. And he said, go work on a newspaper, go work at a wire service. So I started to apply. Nobody really was hiring me. So I went home. I was living in London. I went home and got a job at the local Boston CBS affiliate and started at the bottom and loved every single day.
Oh, it's amazing.
Even at the bottom, I loved it.
How wonderful.
Have actually loved every day since, believe it or not.
And then CBS News, just in time for Watergate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know why I got on Watergate? Mm-mm. I was the newest person in the bureau because no one thought it was anything but a local Washington, D.C. break-in. And so they said, okay, well, it was at the Democratic National Headquarters, so we'll send her just to make sure. Why not?
Yeah.
And that's how it.
That was the very beginning. That was the very beginning. And you've covered, you know, Watergate, President Ford, White House correspondent for Presidents Carter, Reagan, and the beginnings of Bush 41. And then last November, you interviewed Donald Trump and his family. You've seen so many changes over the years doing this. And, you know, what are some of the significant changes in how the White House has dealt with the press over the years, specifically since Inauguration Day of this year?
The changes have been, it's as big as an explosion of major proportion.
Yeah.
Because for generations, and when I got to the White House in 1976, the networks were the major way that presidents communicated with the public. In other words, they needed us.
Yeah.
And we were the center of the rhythm of the government because the president wanted to get his message across, and we were on the air at 6:30 every night, and the whole country watched television news at 6:30. I mean, the whole country. And so we were little princes and princesses.
Yeah.
And then along came cable, and there was no deadline at 6:30. There was a 24-hour deadline. So our role got a little diminished, and then along came the internet and social media. And, you know, we are not nearly as important. We're still important, but not nearly. But the real change is that reporters today do not have any time to think, to make calls, to read background material on whatever the subject is. And I don't want to sound like an old fuddy-duddy grandmother, but I do not think this is an improvement, let's say.
Yeah. And I mean, with the Trump administration, it's been a lot tougher for reporters to kind of find their way through this. But there's a lot of people who think, well, this is new. There has not always been fabulous relationships between presidents and the press. You had mentioned
there's
before.
There's never fabulous relationships.
No.
I was covering Watergate, as you said, so I go back to the Nixon administration. And I think the situation was even worse.
Yeah.
There was more hostility, if you can believe it, with the vice president running around the country on a campaign to hurt the press.
Well, in the Carter administration, you had mentioned, used to call and just yell at you because they didn't like the way you covered a story.
Oh, yeah. Jody Powell would pick up the phone, call me, and just scream at me.
Yeah.
And thank God it was on the phone because I cried.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that abusive. My father didn't yell at me, so I wasn't used to this.
Yeah.
And, so the you're right. The relationship between the White House press corps and the president has never been good. And I understand that it was horrible during the Obama administration.
Yeah, yeah. But Reagan was a whole different story.
Reagan was a different story because it was also professional.
Right.
You know, this is an interesting thing. The Democrats who take over the White House, they have an expectation that the press is going to be on their side. The sort of sense, the image, the assumption that the press is liberal. So the Democrats think we're going to give them, we're going to give them a break. And when we don't, they feel betrayed. And that sense of betrayal turns into hatred for us, toward us. The Republicans don't expect that. At least this was true of the Reagan administration with so many professionals running the White House. And they treated us so fairly, without emotion, without that sense that we owed them anything or they were expecting anything. It was just straightforward. There was less, believe this, there was less sexism toward me.
Interesting. Okay.
In the Reagan White House than in the Carter White House, with President Carter promoting the Equal Rights Amendment, Ronald Reagan being against the Equal Rights Amendment, and yet the way they dealt with the women reporters was
different level of
more
respect.
Fair.
Interesting.
More equitable.
Is there any time, because you were in Washington for so long and host of Face the Nation and so forth, do you miss Washington?
I do.
Okay.
I
All
do.
Right. Okay.
I don't think I'd want to be covering the Trump White House per se, but I miss having a daily piece of the story, yes.
Ah, interesting.
I do.
Interesting.
And being able to interview, as I did on Face the Nation, the newsmaker of the day. Because as you see on 60 Minutes, I did interview President Trump 3 days after he was elected,
right,
and that
right.
was great. But most of our stories are what we call on the bias. So if there's a big story, we're trying to do something that's not the daily story. We're
gotcha.
Trying to give you a little depth or a little side story
sure.
that's related. So I miss being in the center of it all the time.
Gotcha. Can you share anything you're working on for 60 Minutes? Anything exciting?
I have three more stories for this season. You know, we go into reruns in late May.
Yeah, we're getting close.
I have interviewed a man who is the last surviving prosecutor of Nuremberg.
Wow. Yeah, that's a wow.
It's a wow.
Yeah.
And he became an expert on war crimes. And he's 95, and so altogether, it's kind of breathtaking. He's younger than I am, really. In every
wow,
way,
yeah,
really,
yeah.
With a perfect memory of the trial and the fact that he, before that, had gone into the concentration camps with the military liberators and remembers all of it. So this is a very emotional and smart interview with a great man. So that's coming along. And I have Tom Dart is the sheriff of Cook County.
Yeah, right.
I have a profile of him.
Awesome.
Coming
Looking
along very
that.
Soon
yeah.
in a couple of weeks. So those two and one more about a federal judge in the Ninth Circuit, which is the court that will look at the president's travel ban again. He's in the appeals court. So. Yeah,
big stories coming
three
up.
Good ones,
three
yeah.
big ones coming up. Well, Leslie's new book is now in paperback. It's Becoming Grandma, the Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. And, of course, you can catch Leslie every Sunday evening at 6 Central on 60 Minutes on CBS. Leslie, thrill having you in studio.
Thank you, David. Thank you. To be with you again.
Thank you. A pleasure. Pleasure is all mine. News is next on 720 WGN.